Bhadram karne vishnu yama devaha Bhadram pashye marshadhirya chatraha Stirairangai istushtubhagum sastanubihi Yashema devahitam yadayuhu Swastina indro vriddashravaha Swastina pusha vishvavedaha Swastina starakshu arishanemihi Swastino brahaspatirtadatu Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. Let's start with three. I'm going to read three and four together. And just review three and go on to four, because they are kind of a set. Repeat after me. Vishwo hi stulabuk. Vishwo hi stulabuk. Nityan thai jasaha. Nityan thai jasaha. Pravivikta-buk. Pravivikta-buk. Ananda-buk. Ananda-buk. Tathā-prāgnyaha, tathā-prāgnyaha, tridhā-bhogam-nibhodata, tridhā-bhogam-nibhodata, stūlam-tarpayati, stūlam-tarpayati, stūlam-tarpayati viśvam, stūlam-tarpayati viśvam, pravivikta-tu-tājasam, pravivikta-tu-tājasam, Anandascha tatha prajñam Anandascha tatha prajñam Tridha triptim nibodhata Tridha triptim nibodhata. Let's do the next one too. Trishu dhamasu yad bhojyam Trishu dhamasu yad bhojyam Bhokta yascha prakirtitaha Bhokta yascha prakirtitaha Vedaitad upayamyastu, Vedaitad upayamyastu, Sabhunjano nalipyate, Sabhunjano nalipyate. The first three that we went over last week, I'm just going to kind of read through it just to remind us. The standpoint of the jiva, the waker is called Vishwa, the dreamer is called Tejasa, the waker dream is called Tejasa, and the deep sleeper is called Pragna. These are the three words that we have. So in this verse, number three, the Vishwaha, the waker, he indeed is Stulabhut. He's the one who enjoys this gross physical world. By Stula, what we mean by Stula are those physical objects that we can perceive through sense perception. That's what makes it gross. Sukshma are the objects that are we perceive them mentally without the use of our sense organs. Like, for instance, memory. Any memory is a dream or imagination. You know, that's sukshma. That's just being perceived in the mind without the use of the sense organs. So here he says, Vishwa, the waker, is Stulabhut, the one who's enjoying the physical world through sense perception. Then Taijasaha is Pravivikta-bhut, means the experiences of the Taijasa, of the dreamer, are not connected to the sense organs. They're independent, right? They're taking place without the use of the sense organs, so they're Pravivikta-bhut, being enjoyed without the use of sense organs. So that's Sukshma, subtle. Then Anandabhut tatha prajñaha. Similarly, the deep sleeper is the one who enjoys ananda. Ananda is just the nature of your being plus the ajñānam. It's not a nirvikalpa samadhi. It's just the mind is in unmanifest condition at that time. It's in the avyakta state. And so the mind itself is not creating any problems for you. There's no subject object, there's no anxiety, there's no depression, there's nothing, there's no joy and compassion and all these things either. The whole thing is an unmanifest condition. And so just the wholeness of your being plus ajnana is there. That's why it's called Ananda Book, because the Ananda is, by here, Ananda, from the standpoint of the Ajnanam, it's the Ananda of not, and Shankara says this, Swamiji talks about it also, the Ananda of not having any stress. So, in deep sleep, you get rid of all the anxiety, all of the stress, and I can just be. We take that for granted. That is an incredible recognition. And it is the recognition that Bhagavan gives us every single night, that we look forward to that deep sleep, just shutting your eyes, relaxing, sinking back into yourself. You don't really think about what you're doing, but we do it all the time. Shut your eyes, relax, sink back into yourself, let me just be. That means that this me, that I just like to be me, that's the Ananda we're talking about. Just let me just be me. Just let me just be. Without all of this stress, without all of this pressure, just let me relax into my own swarupa, into my own nature, which is not like, sparklers going off. It's not blasting bliss, blasting bliss states. It's much more than that. It's much more complete than that. It's just the natural wholeness of my being, and we get to enjoy that every night in kind of what I call, Swamiji calls it the lazy man samadhi, or we can call it ajnana samadhi, the ajnana, the samadhi into ignorance, that just absorb into total ignorance. Swamiji always joke and say, total ignorance is bliss. Partial ignorance is a big problem, but total ignorance is bliss. It's nothing bothering me, nothing wrong. I don't know anything at all. So it's Ananda. So the Ananda book, the one who enjoys that Ananda. So again, when we're talking about these three states of experience, they're states of experience which are enjoyed. Right? So what enjoyed means experienced, really. So I can enjoy it positively and negatively. Well, this is, enjoy, which means experience. So the waking state is an experience. As we'll see, the waker and the waking state, the relationship between the waker and the waking state is very important, just like the experience of the dreamer and the dream state and the non-dual experience in the deep sleep state. But let's go on to the next verse for that. So he says that the third one, Prajnaha, enjoys the Ananda book. And then he says, Trida Bhogam Nibodhate. These are the three states, the three enjoyments. Bhoga means an enjoyment, an object of enjoyment. So we can also say object of experience. Right? So bhoga, we usually think of it as enjoyment. But in this case, the waking state is an object of experience, means it's experienced. Object of experience means there's a subject object there. The waking state is known, it's an experience. It's something that is experienced by Vishwa. Vishwa is the waker. The dream state is experienced by Taijasa. Taijasa is the dreamer. Prajna is the one, the Ananda book of the deep sleep state where there is no subject-object duality. That's why totally free from stress. And so it's just your being plus this resolution of the mind into its, what we call the avyakta, its unmanifest condition, its causal condition. And so then that state also is an experience. Right? The deep sleep is an experience. Just like now, this is an experience. You don't say I'm deep sleeping right now. Right? And the dream is another type of experience. And you're not saying I'm dreaming right now. I had a dream last night. Right? So that's dream experience, waking experience, deep sleep experience. I, the waker, who's analyzing these three states of experience, I also slept well. I slept deeply. That is an experience that you are recalling. Just like the dream experience, that's a recollection. Right? And I can tell you what the dream was. Right? So when I'm telling you what the dream is, I'm having a memory of the dream. When I'm describing to you the deep sleep, time when I was not dreaming, I wasn't aware of anything. I can describe that I slept so well, I wasn't aware of anything, it was wonderful. These are all descriptors of that state of experience which I now have a memory of. And so these are three different states, really, of the mind, the waking state. In the waking state, the experience that the mind is enjoying at that time is generated by the sense perceptions. In the dream state, it's a dual, but it's not generated by sense perception. It's free of sense perception. In the deep sleep state, the mind is in avyakta, it's unmanifest. But these, when they say ananda book, it means there's the experience of that ananda that I then wake up from and I describe. So waking, dream, deep sleep are three states of experience. And so now, what he does is in this verse 4, he goes, stulam tarpayate vishwam. He says, vishwam, something confusing me about. I looked at these before, but I didn't notice this particular grammatical situation here. I want to make sure that I didn't misunderstand something. I'll just tell you what this problem is. And I mean, I was translating the same way this man translates it, Gambarananda, but the problem is for Sanskrit people, in case anybody's online, but this is the problem. In verse 3, the Vishwaha hi stulabhut, these are a nominative case. Taijasaha pavivikta-bhut, Taijasaha is nominative. Anandabhuk is nominative, Prajnaha is nominative. In this verse, 4, stulam tarpayati vishwam, they're an accusative. And I don't know why the vishwa is an accusative. But what it's saying is, see what it is. Oh, this is what it is. It goes like this. Stulam, the physical world, tarpayate is causal. It causes vishwa. This is why it's an accusative. Tarpayate. It causes the vishwa, the waker, to be full. Trip means to be satisfied. So it's this waking state that fulfills vishwa. The vishwa, the waker is satisfied by the waking state. Right? That's its food in a way. That's what it enjoys. That's what it experiences. So it says it in this way. The stula, the physical world that's perceived by the sense organs, that's what brings about satisfaction to the waker. Trip means to satisfy, to bring about that satisfaction. Then he says, pravivictam, that state of experience which is free from sense perception, that Tadapiyate, we have to bring that back again, Tadapiyate, Tajasam, that satisfies the dreamer, the Tajasa. Then he says, Anandaha, because Stulam and Pravivictam are neuter nouns, are neuter. Anandaha is masculine. So he says, Ananda brings about satisfaction to the Prajna, to the deep sleeper. All he's saying is, what fills the experience for the Vishwa is the Stula, Upadi, right? That's what comes in to the experience. So that's what's filling the experience for the waker. What's filling the experience? What is satisfying? It's almost like, what is the Tajasa eating? What is the waker eating? What's coming into that experience? What's fulfilling, what's satisfying the experience? Is the waking world? Is that which is perceived through sense perception? What is filling the experience for Tajasa? That is the subtle world, which is not being generated at this time, at that time, by the sense organs. And what is bringing about fullness or satisfaction to the deep sleeper is Ananda, the very Ananda Swarupa of the self, actually, with Ajnanam, because there is nothing blocking that Ananda at that time. You know, there's no stress. There's no competition. In deep sleep, there's just pure Ajnana with no duality to compete with the Ananda. Whereas in the waking state and the dream state, there are many moods and emotions, many types of vrittis, different types of emotion and affect, which compete with your own nature. Like, for instance, if in this world of sense perception, when you're engaging with the world, your mind can have variety of reactions and, say, produce pain, painful emotional states, and painful physical states. Those painful states are in competition with your own wholeness. They're juxtaposed against your own wholeness. And when there's no viveka there, then the focus of the mind goes on to the unusual state. This is another thing. This is a discernment. It's an important viveka. The unusual state are the states of mind, the experiences that come and go. They're differentiated against each other, like a happy state versus a sad state, an anxious state versus an angry state. These are juxtaposed one against the other, and they differentiate. We have very good viveka, very, very astute, clean, you know, profoundly clear viveka in reference to one mental state versus another mental state. I can say I was feeling this way, and then I was feeling this way, and then I was feeling this way, and then I was feeling this way. I'm making a discernment, right? And I can say I'm perceiving this, and then I'm perceiving this, and then I'm perceiving this. I'm hearing this, then I'm hearing this, then I'm hearing this. There's viveka, there's discernment. One state is differentiated from another state, one experience from another experience. Where there is no viveka initially is the viveka between the experiencer, the conscious being, and the state. See what I mean? We experience one state from another, but we don't, and that's beautiful viveka, but we don't differentiate me from the changing states. And the me, the self, that is present to all of the changing states, actually just becomes taken for granted and totally superimposed on the states. And so the viveka is only taking place between our changing experiences, not between me and the changing experiences that are coming and going in me. See what I mean? They come and go in me. I remain exactly the same. They come and they go. They come, they're experienced, and they go. I don't come and go. But because I'm the constant in every single experience, I'm as though invisible. Because I'm the same in all experiences, across the board, subtle and physical, because I'm exactly the same in all experiences, I don't have to be accounted for. I don't even notice myself. All I notice is the dress I'm wearing. That's all. So it's like now I'm bathed by the waking state and all the experiences it has to give me. Now I'm bathed by the dream state. Now I'm bathed by the deep sleep state. And so this is what, this is all of the, my discussion is only within the realm of these states. And then, of course, I have this physical body, and sense organs, which are part of the waking state. Then my mind and all of the duality that's produced in the mind is also subject-object duality there. You know? So there's no, this is another thing. This is another thing that makes it difficult. Let's just look at this waking state. In this waking state, in this room, I am the waker, this body, mind, sense organs here, experiencing the waking state, this room. So this waker is experiencing this waking state. Okay. Now, this is the other viveka that is totally missing until it isn't. The conscious me that is present to this physical body, the conscious being that is me, that illumines this physical body with my sense organs and mind, is the same conscious being which illumines the object. In other words, for me, the conscious being only extends to the body, and that's the anyonya adhyasa. I become the waker, I'm the vishwa. So consciousness for me, my consciousness, see this, my consciousness, only goes out as far as the body. It doesn't extend into space here, right? So it just fills the body, really because of the sutra sharira, the subtle body. And so here I am, the vishwa. Now, this is another viveka that we need to discern. Because I'm not just the vishwa. I'm also the virat. I'm not just the waker. I am also the waking state. Okay? I'm not just the subject. I am also the object. And now what makes that very hard to perform that viveka is because the one, when I'm sitting here in this room, I'm experiencing this body from this sthana, my sense organs looking at this body, and out into this room. And so the conscious being seems to be contained in this body. And this conscious being, through the mind and sense organs, is experiencing this room. And so that's why we start with saying, I'm the Vishwa. I am the Vishwa, and this is the Virat. This is Ishwara, and I'm the Jiva, I'm the Vishwa. So Vishwa and Virat. Okay? But actually, if you slow down, what you'll realize is that when you're aware right now, aware of this room through your sense organs, right? You're aware of this room through your sense organs, and an antakarana vritti, a thought modification right now, is being generated in your mind through the sense perception. You understand what I mean? It's not just sense perception coming in. Sense perception is coming into the mind, which forms a thought modification that contains the sense perception. To really understand that, it's like if I were daydreaming, say some of you might even be doing this right now, you know, I'm talking away, but you're daydreaming, right? And so your mind's off somewhere thinking about something. And then you come back, and oh gee, I just missed all of that. Mm-hmm. What was she saying? I just missed that whole thing. Because it's the same thing when you read a whole page in a book, you miss most of it, and you realize, oh, I read that whole page, I have no idea what I was reading. Yeah? Your mind has to be using those sense organs in order for there to be a perception. So what that means is your sense perception is forming a thought modification in your mind which you are illumining. Which the whole thought modification is illumined by awareness. The thought modification comes into awareness. You light up the whole thing, okay? Now this is the question. Just look at your perception right now, that you're having right now of this room, is a thought modification, which includes the perception of your body. It's all of this and the perception of your body through your sense organs, giving a thought modification which takes place in awareness. I could say, which takes place in you, in your being. And so now in this thought modification of this room, this three-dimensional room, so now I have this three-dimensional thought modification, where am I not in this thought modification? In terms of my just experience, say I experience a thought, where am I not in that thought? Understand what I mean? Like, let me just do this. Close your eyes and have a thought modification, a memory of this room. Okay? And you have a memory of the room. You're imagining the room. And is there any place or anything in that imagination that is away from you? You can open your eyes. Is there anything that is away from you? No. You would have to say, I am the self of the entire thought. Right? That's so very obvious on the Tejasa level, on the subtle level. Right? It's very obvious that I am the self of the whole thought modification. But do you know that your sensory perception gives you a thought modification in the same way, it's being given to you through sense perception, but it is a thought modification just like your memory is a thought modification, or your imagination is a thought modification, or your dream is a thought modification. So, in fact, all knowledge that you have, all experience that you have, is yourself, the conscious being, which is self-evident me, plus the thought modification, whether it's Vishwa, coming from sense organs, or Tejasa, just being generated by the mind, like for instance memory or imagination or dream, you know, or deep sleep. All of these are nothing but thought modifications which I pervade. Now what this means is that there is no experience which is not me. You see what I mean? Well, when I say it is not me, if I ask you to, say, for instance, imagine an apple, a beautiful apple, a pink lady apple, okay? You imagine an apple. You are the self of that thought modification. You see that? You're the self of the thought modification. It comes to you, it's sustained by you, it goes back into you. All thought modifications are like that. It doesn't matter if it's generated by sense perception or imagination or dream. It comes into your being and goes out of your being. You know, it appears, it's sustained, and it resolves. That's the entirety of your experience. You can't get away from that experience. The only getting away from it, it's not really getting away from it, it's just going back in deeply into yourself, you know, in meditation or something. And then all you're doing is getting away from the mitya or the maya experience. But still, the whole thing is only you. So now, that being so, think of a dream. Think of a dream that you've had. In the dream, if I say, you are both the subject and the object, you are the dreamer and the dream world. You're the dream character and you're the dream world. You see how that is? Because the dream comes from you, is sustained by you, goes back into you. So you're not only the whole dream, you are everything in the dream. In the sense that the dream comes from you, is sustained by you, goes back into you. You're the conscious being which the dream enjoys. You're the existence which the dream enjoys. You're the substance of the dream. And the dream, the whole dream, has no reality other than you. Right? Because where does it go then when you wake up? It doesn't have another place to go. So it comes from you, is sustained by you, and it resolves back into you. So what does that mean? Is that you are the stable, pervasive experience, presence, to the whole dream, and equally to the whole waking state. So now that's more difficult viveka. It's an easy viveka for when I'm asking you to think of the dream or the imagination. to recognize that you are the self of your imagination, that you're the self of the dreamer and the dreamt, of the character and the imagination and what you're imagining. That's easy for you. And to see that the dream is nitya, that's maya, it doesn't have any being of its own, that you are the substance there, easy. That's why Bhagavan gave us the dream. So I'm going to joke sometimes. Bhagavan gave us that, so you can understand. But now, if you realize that this waking state, it's not a different condition. In the sense, we have to go through and do logic to show you that really this outside world is nothing but consciousness. But I'm talking about now your experience. It's a thought modification given to you by sense perception. That thought modification that takes place in the mind is just a thought modification, as it's a dream state, just a thought modification, as an imagination, just a thought modification. The dream thought modification, you definitely see I'm the self of the whole. I'm equally the self of the whole. I'm the subject and the object. Right? In the waking state, there is no difference. There is no difference because all that you are responding to right now is a thought modification. And in the same way you are the self of the dream thought modification, you are the self of the waking state thought modification. You see that? So now if you just relax and sit quietly for a minute and just experience with your eyes open this room, you ask yourself, is there some place in the room of my experience which is away from me, that is away from me, the conscious being? You can say, I'm 15 feet from that painting. My body is 15 feet from that painting, which is true. But is it 15 feet from me? The me, my own presence, the conscious being. And that's a really, even walking around open-eyed meditations, as you walk around or as you sit anywhere, just notice where is the awareness? Where is the awareful being? Where is it located? Where is it located? What?
In us.
I would say, when you say that it's located in us, I would want you to try this. How about it's located in the room? How about if the room, whatever your room stands for, just what you're experiencing right now, is located in awareness? How about you say the whole room is located in me? Right? And so if this whole room is located in me, then the wall is in me, the space is in me, the body is in me, the sense organs are in me, the mind is in me, everything is pervaded or has me as its being. So you can say, we can talk like these words, but these words have to land on, these words are actually trying to describe the experience that I want you to see. That's the thing. And so that's what they're trying to do here. Like it's for the Vishwa, when he says, it's this waking, this whole waking state, you know, that is what satisfies, or what is the experience of the Vishwa, of the waker. All of this is my field. And that's why in the previous verses he said, you know, this Vishwa is Virat. This Vishwa itself is Virat. The one who enjoys the waking state is the one who enjoys the waker, is identified with the waker, is the one who is identified with the whole. Because there's only one conscious being. So the conscious being which Vishwa enjoys is the very conscious being that Virat enjoys. So I am both Virat and Vishwa from the standpoint of consciousness. And it's the same, he says, Taijasaha, the Pravivikta book, that's the Pravivikta, these perceptions, this dream world that's not associated with the waking state, That is the realm of Taijasa. Taijasa is the awareful being that is present in this state. Right? And for Prajnaha, that is me, the same awareful being that is present in that state. So he says these are the three triptis, the three satisfactions that are available. One to the Vishwa, one to Taijasa, and one to Prajna. And now he's going to say the same thing in the next verse, a little bit differently. He says, Trishu Dhammasu. In all of these three states, Dhamma is the same as Dhamma, is the same as Avastha. Trishu Dhammasu, in these three states of experience, Yad Bhogyam, that which is thing to be enjoyed, Bhokta Yahacha, and the one who is the enjoyer. So that which is the enjoyed and that which is the enjoyer, these things are stated here. Then he says, Veda, the one, Yaha Veda, the one who knows both of these, Etad Ubayam, he, Saha, Bunjanaha, Nalipyate. He says, that one, even enjoying, while enjoying, Nalipyate, is not touched. Even enjoying all of this is not touched. Who? The one who knows, the one who is the enjoyer, and the one and that which is the enjoyed in all three of these three states, the one who knows that one, even while enjoying, is not stained, is not touched by it. To me, you know, the whole freedom of Vedanta is in this verse, really. Let me just explain a little bit. It's such a thorough analysis of the totality of your experience. This is really the Mandukya. So let's just look at how he's wrapping up this little section. There's like two different types of discernment here. On the one hand, there's the recognition that in the waking state, the experience of the what they call the bhogya, that which is enjoyed. That which is enjoyed is experienced through the sense perception, but also the enjoyer is also objectified. Like this. I'm aware, so this is the one viveka that puts your body, mind, sense organs into the world. Right? I'm aware of this world through my sense perception. But then I have to realize that I'm also aware of this physical body through the same sense perception. Without your sense organs, there is no perception of this physical body, just like there would be no perception of the world. And so the physical body, the bhokta, is an object of enjoyment, is an object of perception, as well as the world. And so this body actually belongs to the waking state. Now you have to think of it like this. The waker, this body, this physical body with these sense organs, belongs to these physical eyes, physical sense organs, physical body, belongs to the waking state. So the waker is actually part of the waking state. And so the vishwa is part and parcel of virat, right? Of virat, not separate. And so the waker, the subject, the knower, and the known are both part of virat. Right? And so what that means also is that if we do this viveka going this way a little bit, the physical world is perceived by your sense organs, as is the physical body. Okay? If we go in one step further, we notice that the sense organs themselves are perceived by the mind, right? And so your mind illumines the sense organs and the physical body and this waking state. And so now what happens is that the conscious being has been, the self, the I, has been removed, has been taken inward, more inward, away from the physical body, giving the physical body over to Virat, over to Ishwara, really. Okay, so we notice this. We can do this viveka, and we do this viveka, you know, teaching these prakriyas within the waking state so that you can realize that, actually, not only is this world Ishwara that I perceive, I can see this whole universe, this whole creation is Ishwara, but I have to realize that the physical body is also part of Ishwara. Mm-hmm. It's all made of the same material, and it's also illumined. And so the consciousness which Vishwa enjoys, the waker enjoys, is the consciousness which Virat enjoys, because I've differentiated myself from this physical body because I can objectify it in the same way that I objectify the world. Okay, so now consciousness has been differentiated from the physical body and the sense organs and even the mind, because the mind is objectified. And so now Vishwa becomes part of Virat. But so that's one viveka. Now another, having done that viveka, what about when I recognize that when I'm in a dream state, when I'm having that state of experience, I don't have a waking state of experience. The same self, you know, that's called a pratyabhijna. I can say, I am the one who dreamt last night. I can describe the dream. I can talk to you about what form I had in the dream, who I was in the dream. When I'm in the dream, there is no waking state. There is no deep sleep state. I even have a different body. It's a whole different world that I'm experiencing. But it's the world that I am experiencing. The me. I am there. I am in the waking state.
Oh, that's me. I'm so sorry.
But,
huh? I can't stand up on my feet.
I know, just get a little bit of it. You have to learn how to turn that thing off.
Yeah.
Don't worry about it, Edward. It's okay. Okay, so when I have the, when I have the waking, when I have the dream state, versus the waking state. These two states of experience totally negate each other, but I have no trouble with myself as being the self of both of them. You know? And it's also, and this is just sitting with this experience. Nothing happens to me. There is no transition that I make between the waking state and the dream state. The two states totally negate each other, but nothing happens to me. you know. Nor do I find any weirdness in it at all. It's perfectly all right for me to pass through these two states, even though everything I identify with as me in the waking state is left behind in the dream state. Different world, different body, different situation. Can even be, it could be an animal body or a different gender, different age. It makes no difference. It is fine, and it is still myself. We're talking about extreme negation without us having any problem. And there's also no problem with me going into deep sleep state. So this is that anvayavyatireka logic. When the waking state is, I am. When the dream state is, which totally negates the waking state, I still am. When the deep sleep state is, which totally negates the waking state and the dream state, I still am. If that's the case, my being cannot be dependent on these experiences. Your nature, who you are, we're just talking on an experiential level here. Anything, any experience that you can leave behind, any experience that you can be without, is not you, because you can be without it. Who you are, you can't be without. So then, they say, well, what about in the deep sleep state when I can't, when I don't know anything? Well, what does that mean? It means you're not a knower. It means knowership is not your nature, subject-object. It's not that your conscious being is not, but you're not performing an act. You're not performing any act. That freedom from knowership, freedom from enjoyership, is something that is aparoksha, self-evident, right now. That's why when we were... Just a second. That's why when we were in the... in the meditation, you don't... to have that viveka, to notice that you're not doing anything. In meditation, when I was saying, you know, that these thoughts come and go, see if you're doing anything. Even right now, to notice that all of these things, that's all the perceptions that are taking place in your awareness, you are not doing anything. You simply are. You're not performing an action. Even thoughts, the ahankara, the I'm doing this and I'm doing that, those are just thoughts that are being illumined by you who aren't doing anything. And so the thing is that noticeable or not. What he's saying in this verse, in this verse 5, says those who understand this, you know, that in fact I am both the enjoyer and the enjoyed. I see all of these things arising and setting in consciousness. For such a person, even while enjoying these, I'm not touched at all. So even while enjoying all of this, by experiencing all of this, by experiencing the dream state, by experiencing the deep sleep state, by experiencing all of the whole display of emotions that are taking place in the waking state, in the dream state, all of it, experiencing all of these, I remain untouched. Now the thing is, I always remain untouched. This is nothing new. It's just whether or not that viveka is there. It's not as though you've ever been touched. Even if you're thinking, say your mind is saying, oh, I'm having this, you know, I'm feeling upset about this and upset about that, and this happened to me and this happened to me. This is all just stuff that's going on in samsara, lit up by you, who are not doing anything. Absolutely not touched by anything. Say you have a terrible nightmare. So all kinds of emotions, all kinds of... threat and things going on in the nightmare. So frightening, you know. All of that is just taking place in you. It's hard to have that viveka. But say it's a nightmare, and when you wake up, you definitely have the viveka. It's kind of like, oh, thank God, nothing happened. Right? It's, thank God, nothing happened. I'm fine. It was only a dream. Right? Nothing happened to me. Now, when you say nothing happened to me, what you're also saying is, ah, I thought something was happening to me. I thought something was happening to me. This terrible nightmare was going on. This horrible thing was taking place. I'm so glad that nothing happened to me. Now, the fact is, nothing was ever happening to you. Right? But the dream was so scary that your mind was totally swept away and caught in it. But you were in the middle of the nightmare. Nothing was happening to you. You realize it when you wake up. Now what knowledge is asking of us is to realize that now, in this waking state, that nothing, recognize yourself, you know, discern yourself, have that viveka, to notice that nothing is happening to me, nor can it ever happen to me. And in fact, all of this is coming and going in me. If all of these changes, the waking state is negated by the dream state, is negated by the deep sleep state, right? Now, if these all these states of experience are negating each other, they themselves, all the while taking place in me, who is changeless, these states have no reality of their own, because they're coming and going and coming and going. Anything that comes into being and goes out of being is mitya. It's mitya because any experience that's bordered by non-existence like that, it comes into being and goes out of being, can't be real in the middle. You know? If it's bordered by non-existence, then what is it in the middle? What it is in the middle is the truth which it's enjoying while it's there. It's like, it's the same thing. If you mistake a snake on a rope, mistake a rope for a snake, you know, that snake is mitya. It has no real being of its own. It comes upon the rope, is sustained by the rope, and goes back into the rope. It itself doesn't have being. Right? The rope has being. The same with a clay pot. I take a lump of clay, I make it into a pot, I squash it and make it into a plate. The pot doesn't have any being. Right? It comes into being and goes out of being. The only thing that's really there is clay. That's the thing that is real. So something that appears and disappears, but while it is there, it is, right? The thing that is what is real. Right? What is what is real, not the thing that appears and disappears. What is the substratum for what is appearing and disappearing? You know, something that, think about like this. You have to actually reflect on these things. Say if you say something is non-existent. Here's a something non-existent. Well, first of all, something which is non-existent is not a something. It's not there, right? If it's non-existent, it's not there. That's what that means, non-existent. So for something that is not there at all, zero, okay, what is going to come of that? What's going to come from it? Something that's not there. Nothing. And nothing can come from it. So something what is not there cannot produce something which is there. You understand? So now, all of these things which are, all of these things that we experience, they are there. Mm-hmm. It's not that they're not there. Right? All of this is. But all of this which is, the nama rupa, the names and forms, are coming and going. But they're coming and going from something which is, not which something which is non-existent. But which is, that which is not, cannot itself be something which comes and goes. Because anything which comes and goes is intrinsically not there. You get it? No, this is... it might be kind of hard, I don't know, but you have to play with it. Let me just explain it one more time, real quick. If something... So, we start out like this. There's something which is not there, means there's no something. Nothing is there, okay? It's non-existent. If it's non-existent, nothing can come from it, okay? Because it's not there. Clear? Now, what if we take a clay pot and we say the pot, was not there before. The pot, you know, was non-existent, and now it is here. But the pot is here, right? The pot is here. So we can't really say, we can say the pot wasn't here before, but something had to be there, something had to be there, or the pot couldn't come. Because if non-existence was there, there would be nothing there from which it could come. And so we'd say, all right, the pot is bordered by non-existence. It comes into being, goes out of being. But what is actually there, the clay, doesn't come into being and go out of being. Because the clay is what is. The pot enjoys the clay while it is there. Right? And so the clay is the material cause, the being, so to speak, of the pot. Now, if the clay was non-existent also, then we have a problem. And if the clay had a non-existent prior condition, we have a problem. Because then there would be no clay. Because its prior condition is non-existent, and nothing can come from non-existence. But now, you can take this back from in kind of an infinite regress, but what we end up with is this, that what is, there, something has to be there. Something has to be in order for anything to come from it. Right? Otherwise, there is only non-existence. And the way we're using the word does not apply to this. Because this is the experience of existence, of being. So what is the prior condition of this cannot be non-existence, or existence wouldn't be. But the problem is that all of the things that we experience in the creation are bordered by non-existence. Except for this, understanding this. They are bordered by non-existence. But they come into existence and go out of existence. They come into being and go out of being, being remaining the same. So being is the condition, the being which I am, is the condition into which all experiences come and go. The being is what allows for them to be. So the nama-rupas are bordered by non-existence, but not their being. But that's why if you look at it, look at, I say, this is, I cannot have an experience away from being, away from isness. There's no such thing as an experience away from being. All experiences have being. But all experiences have being, but they also come and go in being. Being, amness, me, consciousness, existence, never comes and goes, but all experiences come and go in being, having being for their self, for their isness. Does that make sense? That's what this is all about. And the next verse gets into it quite a bit more. Okay, let's stop there. Yeah, something to think about.
Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vasishyate Om Shanti Shanti Shanti
Harihi Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha Harihi Om. Sorry. can be a so what factor to this. But there isn't really, because the thing is, the nature of yourself is so complete, whole and complete. That's why when we do these kind of meditations, just, you know, what are you like? What is your own being? What is your being like? Is it positive? Is it negative? Can it be improved upon? As you get to recognize yourself, when you see this, there's really nothing there but that, and it's not, nothing can touch you. Nothing can ever touch that wholeness. But that, the thing is, it takes some viveka for that wholeness to come into the forefront, you know, to to overpower, in a way, all of the other experiences. Because all of the other experiences are mitya compared to you, to yourself, and yourself is so whole and complete. These experiences can't really touch it at all. But the problem is that when we first come to knowledge, is that all of the other experiences are what are predominant. The mind is so used to focusing within samsara rather than enjoying the self of the whole thing.
You know? So they seem to dominate.
It dominates, because that's what we're used to. We're only used to differentiating between our experiences. These experiences are better than these. These mental states are better than these mental states. Rather than recognizing the one who's whole, who's the self of all of the different states of experience, letting that one become more into the forefront. And it wouldn't matter, I mean, who cares, except that myself is whole and complete and doesn't need anything to improve itself.
You know, the good self eventually, I think, I don't know, maybe in my case, but sort of becomes a problem, because there is such an objectification, such a thingness that is associated with a noun.
But you know what? Well, that's true.
Yeah.
But the thing is, at least in this tradition, the viveka, you know, like drisha viveka, the seer seeing differentiation, is to what you take to be, what is the self that is taken to be this body, right?
Mm-hmm.
So what the self that is real and true, and is really the self of all beings and the self of everything, right? That by the mind is superimposed on this body, mind, sense organs. So retaining the self and removing from it all of the things that had been dressed, you know, superimposed upon it, leaves you with the self, the one self, which is the self of the whole creation. So that's the teaching. It's not getting rid of the self. It's keeping the self and getting rid of all of the baggage. So then you just end up with just Ishvara.
When you differentiate and you put in place the subject-object, or acknowledge
yeah.
the subject-object relationship, which is so implicit to cognition.
It's so what?
Implicit,
yeah.
so built into cognition. That becomes like, I don't know, dismantling that. It's just...
It has to be dismantled.
Yeah, because, you know, when you were going through the discourse today, and then... it's sort of when in verse 4 there is a recognition again of this differentiation, subject-object differentiation.
Mm-hmm.
This is like, how can I get away from it? Just so then when you got into then the recognition of the essence of being on both sides of the subject-object, this feels like a release for the mind, because otherwise it's so caught in this.
Absolutely.
It is
a huge release for the mind, but it's a release that's brought about by seeing, by recognition, right?
So the word self is completely devoid of the meaning, or should be devoid of the meaning that their tribute habitually as we go through the world.
I say
and it becomes informed by a completely different meaning.
Well, it's the thing is though, it isn't a completely different meaning. Because in this way, when you say, I am, I exist, I am a conscious being, these words, okay? Myself, that I'm, I exist, I'm a conscious being. So that's the self, the existent conscious being. That remains, the conscious, existent conscious being remains, minus the body, minus the sense organs, you know, not being dependent on the body, not dependent on the sense organs, one, the same in all beings. And so, it's not that you lose yourself. You keep the same self minus the false identifications. You know? And so, I think for me that's more real than saying there, than trying to get rid of the word self, because it's kind of like throwing the baby out with the bathwater, you know. Because you are. You are the self, the one self, the Advaita. You are the one self of the whole creation right now. That when you say, I am, you're referring only to that self. And then superimposed on it is the body, mind, sense organs. Taking that one self that is you, you think, is this? But it isn't. It's more like with the Satyam Mithya, you have to say, like the pot is the clay, but the clay is free of the pot. Right? So the body is conscious being, but conscious being is free of the body. It's like the snake is the rope, but the rope is completely free of the snake. Right? So to say that I'm the self is not true. It's just that it's been superimposed on the self has been equated to the body or to the body, mind, sense organs. Mm-hmm. So when the body dies, the self dies. Mm-hmm. And then you want to go in kind of a Buddhist way to say there is no self. But when the Buddhists are doing that, they're only talking about it from the standpoint of the mistaken identity. Like there is no self to be found in this body. This is more like a chariot. You know, it's made of many parts. Where are you going to stick a self? What part of this is the self? Where is it located? There's no location. This thing is infinitely divisible. There's no self here. What about the mind? The mind is just one thought after another. Where is there any self there? You know, you just totally dissect and deconstruct the whole body, mind, sense organs. There's no self to be found here. Therefore, there's no self. That's really not what the Buddha says. He won't use the word self because as the same way you're doing, saying is that the use of the word self is meant only for this body, mind, sense organs, and there's no self there. And there's no such thing as a self.
Okay.
You see? But what we're saying is the self that is you is one non-dual self, which is the truth of the entire creation. And you, your the mind, has superimposed this me, this what makes me, onto the mind and the sense organs and the body. But in fact, the me that I am is the me that you are, is the me that all beings is Ishwara. Mm-hmm. You see what I mean? So we don't throw out that self, which is pure being. The Buddhists will allude to that as a state, right? Mm-hmm. But we say that it's not a state. It's the non-dual presence of myself, the self, which is always there as me. You know? And you even experience it. That's why we do this waking, dream, deep sleep differentiation also. Is to show that that self, even within the waking state, you can't touch it. You can't get rid of it. Everything else you can get rid of. Everything else can be negated in your experience, but that can't be. And it's that same self that is present to all the different states of experience that negate each other. The waking state negated by the dream, negated by the deep sleep state. That self is always present. In it's just as you, without doing anything. It's not a know or anything. It's just that all experience comes into it, and as experience comes into it, it is known. Yeah. There's no experience outside of it either. There's just mithya, changing experiences that have no being apart from me. Mm-hmm. That me is the bottom line, consciousness.
Okay, I can ask more. But...
Yeah, okay.
So, do the Buddhas not acknowledge consciousness?
They have a different whole different teaching methodology. If they're talking, they're talking about consciousness. They're talking about consciousness of something. It's called vijnana. Mm-hmm. So they're not talking about consciousness per se. This is complicated. Why all of that? They're teaching methodologies. If you look at the different teaching, the darshanas in India, the Bauddha is one of them. I'm talking about classical Buddhism. There, a lot of the teaching methodology is based upon the pramanas, the means of knowledge that they're using. And so if you're only using sense perception and inference, which is what they use, sense perception and inference, as valid means of knowledge, then everything they have to say has to be valid within sense perception and inference. And anything that doesn't fall within that, then is going to be a different sort of a realization. So they do a lot of neti-neti. It's not this, not this, not this. There's no atma. Everything is interconnected and interdependent, all of these type of things. It's basic teaching that one has to go through. And then what happens is there's a recognition that can dawn. You know, which is... there's a recognition that can dawn of something which cannot be known through the immediate use of words, meaning of words, through perception, through inference. It's not available for that. We see the same thing. You can't look at awareness. Like here, wouldn't that be easy? Say, see, this is awareness. Everybody see it? See what it looks like? You can't do that. This is consciousness. So what is the substrate being of everything? It's not something that can be pointed to through the immediate meaning of words. But because you are that, words can point to it. Even though it's not there as an object, it's there as you. And it's self-evident. Consciousness is self-evident. So it's not that you're not there. It's just that you're not there as an object. You're there as the ultimate, the pratyagatma, the ultimate subject.
So
who's the same in all beings.
They don't use shabda pramana.
They don't. They don't accept the Vedas. And so, or the Upanishads. The only thing they use for shabda pramana is the words of the Buddha when he was speaking of things that are not in your normal experience. Like he has experiences of going to different lokas and things like that, that he would describe. And they would take those descriptions as authority. That's what Shabda Pramana is. Shabda Pramana means knowledge that takes place through words. And so, for instance, in the Vedas are viewed as Shabda Pramana when they're talking about things that we ourselves can't know. Like, for instance, the difference, the reincarnation. The nature of the different lokas or fields of experience, you know, that the soul goes to when it dies. So most people don't have those experiences here in this loka. And so the Buddha had some experiences of other lokas and some insights which are not available to most of us. And so he described these insights to his students. And they accepted his words as Shabda Pramana, because they had Shraddha in him as an authority, you know, and believed in what he said. That's Shabda Pramana. It's the same for us with the Vedas or the Upanishads. You accept the authority of the Upanishads, what they have to say about these different worlds and those type of things, that you don't have access to that type of knowledge yourself. So it gives you, that's an indirect knowledge. There's another type of Shabda Pramana, which gives direct knowledge, you know, and that's what the teaching methodology of the Vedanta is all about, is the use of words to give direct knowledge, like we use in the 10th man story as an example of that, you know, or there's a lot of stories we can say. The tenth man story is a good example of that. Shabda Pramana that gives direct recognition. And for the Shabda Pramana to give direct immediate knowledge, the object of knowledge has to be present. So if the Upanishads are holding up a mirror to yourself, it can give direct immediate knowledge because you're here. Right? Otherwise, the Shabda gives indirect knowledge, like heaven worlds and that type of thing. For you yourself, you have to take it on faith. You've never seen it. Might make sense to you. It makes sense to me. Reincarnation makes sense to me. That there's different planes of existence makes sense to me. But, and it's logical, and I accept all of that. But I can't prove that. Because I don't have access to all of that. So I have Shraddha. Yeah. And it makes logical sense, etc., like that.
All of these false identifications that we have, that we mistake ourselves for, especially in relation to things of the student or mother, all of these, it seems that as you grow up and you get older through childhood and on, that they actually become more and more important to you. And I don't know, I was just curious, like, is it comforting to the mind?
What becomes more important?
These false identifications of you're telling yourself that you are all these things. I don't know, I just, like, why is that so difficult to let go of? Like, why is that so important to the mind?
Well, you have to be something, right? If you if you don't have self-knowledge, and so you don't know you're the whole, you have to be something, and the something should be, you want the something to be comfortable, like something that you can relax into. So actually it's very simple in this way. If say being a mother, you're a mother and say you have some children, and the children have turned out well, so they're like happy, you're happy with your family, then being a mother, that word mother can relax you. It can evoke love. But if you have some children that are causing you nothing but pain, then being a mother evokes suffering. You know? And that's going to be true about it. Being a teacher, it can evoke love, it can evoke suffering. Being anything can evoke. It depends upon how that particular role is played out for you. And if your mind relaxes in that role, then it's important to you because you feel whole. If your mind can't relax in that role, it's a role you want to get rid of because your mind doesn't relax in it. So really, the situations that you find yourself in where your mind relaxes, then you feel more whole, those are very important to you. You'd much rather have those than the ones where your mind doesn't relax. But for a jnani, the mind always relaxes because it's relaxing into the wholeness of yourself, not into a wholeness that's been superimposed upon comfortable, hopefully comfortable situations. Comfortable situations can become uncomfortable situations. Happy situations can become tragic situations. And so the relaxation and resting and identification with it is tenuous. Am I answering you?
Yeah.
Okay. You know, the most, this is the whole teaching of the Book of the Gita also. Living a dharmic life where your values, where your commitment is to dharma gives you the most shanti, the most relaxation. Because you have some choice over it. The situations in that life gives you are always changing. They just are. That's how it is. They're coming, they're sometimes good, sometimes bad. Good things become bad things, good things. You're going off that all the time. Dharma, your commitment to Dharma is not as what do you call it? It's just not such a wavy ocean, because you have some control over your value system, your values, you know. And that gives you a deep shanti amidst the waves of samsara. It takes you out of samsara somewhat. It moves you, you know, into a kind of a more, much more peaceful plateau, because your value is to dharma, not so much to the roles of the situations, but just what Bhagavan puts you in. So it's how to handle the situation in the best way that I can. When that's the commitment, then the commitment's not so much to the situation as to being appropriate in the situation. And that's kind of the mamukshutvam stance, you know. And then that resolves, finally resolves just into abiding in yourself and letting Ishwar be Ishwar.
But that doesn't diminish your interest in the situations.
It really doesn't. That's why in this book it says, you know, even while enjoying it, experiencing the world, you're not stained, touched by it. Touched by it means nothing happens to you. It's not like you become yourself as becomes damaged by the world. Yourself doesn't ever become damaged by the world, but at the same time you can be, I would say, much, much more engaged in the world than anybody else, really. Because you're not asking for things to be different, so you can be totally involved in your life. You know? And I think it gets so much to, well, you just really don't want anything but your life. Your life is fine. The life that you have is your life, and it's here and you have it. Bhagavan gets the prarabdha. And if you start veering off, saying, oh, this person has this prarabdha, I'd rather have this. So you start swimming in the wrong direction against your own prarabdha. That's treacherous. If you're with your own prarabdha, then Bhagavan takes care of this. Bhagavan, really. You don't have to really do anything except participate in it. Much easier. And why would... See, what makes a person want somebody else's prarabdha? If you know the truth of the whole thing. It's like the graham cracker story. You know, all the graham crackers, all the different animal shapes are just graham cracker, right? They're all just graham crackers. But you want the horse, you don't want the cow. You want the dog, you don't want the cat. That's how this is. But it's all just graham cracker. They're even, each cookie is the same amount of graham cracker. It's just in a different shape. It's exactly the same amount. And you can say they have a bigger one. They have a bigger one. It's just a different shape. They're still exactly the same. That's our situation. It's the same self.
Yeah. Well, that's what my grandmother meant when she said, and I wasn't around, but she lost her husband when she had 8 children, ages 11 months to 11 years. And at some point in her life, she said, everyone has their cross, and I prefer my own.
Wow.
So that's it, isn't
yeah.
it? Yeah.
That's something.
She was very spiritual.
What
choice did she have?
Everyone has their cross, and I prefer my own. That's beautiful, really.
Yeah.
But it's, you know, and I understand. The thing is that the cross contains both sukha and dukkha. The cross of your life.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
It's the whole thing.
It's like, why not have peace with yours, because all of them have both sides anyway.
Everybody has, oh yeah. And if it's yours, then yours is here. That's the thing. You don't have to work for your life. With all its sukha and dukkha and all of its challenges, it is here. There's nothing you have to do. Except be present to it. That's a tremendous freedom if you can just be present to it. But instead, you know, we tend to spend a lot of time worrying about the future and regretting the past. worrying about the past and worrying about the future. And then there's very little time that we're just actually living our life. You know?
I always like Swamiji's fisherman's story.
The Kalpina story?
No, the...
Tell us.
Where the guy, you know, the fisherman goes out in his boat to fish for the catch of what he wants for the day, and then he comes back, and then the person says, "You're done? You're done fishing? You remember that?"
Now tell me. I think I do, but yeah, I don't hear.
And he says, well, why don't you continue fishing? You can get more fish.
Yeah.
And he said that, well, you know, I caught my catch of the day, and that's good enough, you know. And he says, yeah, but think of all the things if you continue fishing, and, you know, you can get more money to get more boats, and then the more boats you get other people fishing for you, and, like, you know, to the point you got this whole fleet, and then what? And he says, well, then with all that, you can buy a house, you can buy a mansion, you can buy a new car, and then what? And he says, when you have all that, then you can go out and walk on the beach. And he says, what the hell do you think I'm doing now?
Yeah, that's right, that's right.
Remember that story?
I do, yes. That's very nice.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You know, it's really amazing how that tradition can preserve the soul intact.
That what?
The tradition preserved all the pramana that you did,
oh, yeah,
didn't deteriorate. It's so amazing.
It's amazing, isn't it?
It's
yeah,
so amazing.
It's beautiful.
Yeah, and I keep marveling at how they did it,
yeah,
because there is nothing which can be even remotely comparable to this consistent preservation of knowledge,
yeah,
orally, scripturally. It's amazing.
Yeah, yeah, it's really amazing.
Just
such a value. It was all handed down orally.
Yes.
And so all memorized. The whole teaching tradition was memorized and passed down orally. And so to make sure that it was passed down properly, there's all these memorization techniques and swaras and things that they do in memorizing in volumes of teaching material. And then the methodology for teaching it is passed down from teacher to student.
So
now we all have everything in books, but
yeah,
for so long it didn't have any value for books. If books, then what's in your mind? Why is it, you put it in a book, it should be in your mind. That's it.
So
there
aren't all these disputes then of what was said or what was meant. That clarity is just thrived in its own self.
In terms of the Upanishads and the Vedas, exactly the words that are there are memorized meticulously and passed down through the ages from teacher to student. Then commentaries have been written on the meaning of those things. And they're only, in the Advaita tradition, we have Shankara and then Gaudapada. And before that, it was just oral. Shankara really is the one who put a lot of them into writing.
Really? So he was the one to record all the commentaries?
Well, there were some other things, but they've been lost. But Shankara is the one who did such a systematic writing of all of the commentaries. But what he's saying is not just his. He's also putting into very clear writing what he also has taught. And we have Gaudapada's Kadika, who was Shankara's guru's guru. That's what we're doing right now. And so Shankara, what he did was, there's the Upanishads, and then there's Gaudapada's commentary on the Upanishads. So Shankara actually wrote his commentary on Gaudapada's Kadika, out of respect, right? Because Gaudapada wrote the Kadika, it's in verse form, is a explication of the Upanishads and writing more than what the Upanishads said, but on the subject matter of what the Upanishad was saying. And since Gaudapada was Shankara's guru's guru, then Shankara, accepting what Gaudapada wrote a commentary on what Gaudapada wrote to help clarify it.
Okay, and so the commentaries of this extensive quality jobless nature, they do exist only with regard to Mandukya Upanishad.
But no, there's other commentaries.
If you take, yeah, Brihadaranyaka.
Yeah, there's a commentary. There's, I think, a tika and a, not karika, I forget what they, there's different words like vritti, bhasha, tika, karika. You know, there's different types of commentaries. But the Brihadaranyaka has Shankara's bhasha. It also has something, I think, by Sureshwara that's in verse form.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's also commentaries of commentaries. Like I'll read Shankara's bhasha, and then Anandagiri writes a tika on Shankara's bhasha.
So,
and I get some of the words for all of these different types of commentaries.
So, Gaudapada, let's say if you took it like a family,
yeah,
would be like the grandfather guru.
Well, yeah, the grandfather.
Okay, and he wrote the Karika.
Yeah, and then Govindapada was...
like the father.
The father, and Shankara was the...
Shankara was guru.
Yeah, the guru, yeah, the teacher. So, yeah, Shankara's guru, right.
Okay. And then when Shankara did his commentary, which we call the Bhashya, right?
Yeah.
That was based on the Gaudapada's
Karika. Exactly.
So it's the other way around. Mm. I mean,
yes, because the Upanishad is beginningless in a sense.
Yeah.
So Gaudapada wrote a Karika just on the wrote verses to go along and support the Upanishad.
Okay.
So those are the verses that we're doing right now.
But those were...
There was no bhasha.
Yeah, but they were not on all verses. They were just few and far between.
What it goes, how they arranged it here is they, and I think the arrangement is kind of subjective. You could take all of those verses that are now showing up in the middle of the Upanishad verses. There's only 12 verses in the Upanishad. You could study all of those verses and then study the Karika from verse 1 all the way through of the 4 chapters. But the way that it seems to be traditionally arranged is some of Gaudapada's first verses refer only to the first 4 or 5 Upanishad verses, so they stick them there. Then they stick another several after another couple of verses, and then they just begin the next chapter. See what I mean? Just because those verses are directly related to the Upanishad verses.
So Shankara's bhashya is more elaborate, though.
Shankara's bhashya is really an unfoldment and an explication of Gaudapada's verses.
Mm.
You know,
because I noticed after Gaudapada does, you go through those verses, when we come back to the Upanishad, there's going to be all these Purvapakshas.
Yeah, the Purvapaksha. There are some Purvapakshas in Gaudapada's verses. Like in 2 verses from now, there's a Purvapaksha. The verse itself is a Purvapaksha, what other people are saying. And then Shankara, in his commentary, will do a lot of Purvapaksha Siddhanta.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just Purvapaksha.
Purvapaksha means an objection.
Oh, okay.
And then the Siddhanta is the response.
Oh,
to the answer to that objection.
Okay.
Yeah.
But they create the other objection themselves.
Yeah.
Just to clarify.
For clarification, exactly. Exactly.
But aren't the objections sort of taken from the literature of the time, too? I mean,
oh, yeah.
it's a recognition of...
what others... Yeah, that's right. Well, it can be both. Like here, in the objection that the Karika is coming up in 2 verses, these are what the Sankhyas are saying, what the Nyayayikas are saying, and so they're objections that he's drawing on from other schools of thought. There's another way, though, that you'll, especially with Shankara, he'll be bringing in objections from other schools of thought, but also, if he thinks of an objection, you know, that somebody could say, he'll bring that in, too. And they even have a way of saying that, it's almost like saying, someone might say, but there's an actual way that he says that, you know.
So, they started recording, Shankara recorded commentaries or what commentary is, but is there a time period where oral tradition, when the oral tradition becomes more recorded? Or
I think it's around Shankara's time.
So there even is a certain historical time.
Yeah, even though there'll be mention of other ones, they're lost. Like, so in some of the books, they'll mention a commentary, but nobody has that commentary anymore. So we know that there's some other commentaries, but they become extant.
Upanishads themselves, though, they remained intact.
They remained intact because they're Vedic, and they're always memorized. The whole Vedas are memorized.
How do they date the Vedas?
Traditionally, the Vedas are beginningless, and they come with the creation. And so if you have people dating them, then those are academics coming in and trying to apply
the academic criteria. Yeah,
the academic criteria to apply dates. But so within the tradition, they don't.
Tradition says that Vedas are beginningless, and mm-hmm. so are Upanishads. So those texts, they existed as texts as far as...
That's right. They also do say that through the yugas, in different yugas, there was much more Vedic material.
Before,
available
in
the first and second yuga. In this yuga, there's not as much available. That's all kind of in the... You have to read the Puranas and all of the stories.
But it's supposedly we're getting into a better yuga now, so...
The what?
We're getting supposedly into Dwapara Yuga from the Kali Yuga, so it kind of... The count begins back now, so...
Yeah, maybe. Some people say, yeah. Yeah.
So, okay. So we may recover part of this material. There are new legends like that, myths like that, that the part of the lost material may be coming back.
There may be, but I'm not that well versed in all of that. And all I really know about that, because I haven't done a lot of study of my own on it, I only know what Swamiji has told me, you know, over the years that come up in stories or whatnot. But I haven't made a study of it.
It's very interesting, you know, because if you take, if one believes that this whole, you know, that there is a proto-culture within the European proto-culture, and then there is Greek culture, and then Iranian, and Indian springing from that, and you have this Indian which preserves the tradition the most, and then Greek which goes in a completely different direction, logically.
If you study it,
Iranian, which is,
if you study it linguistically,
dismantled.
You know, really everything goes back to Sanskrit. And above Sanskrit there is a hypothetical language that they call Wiros, or something like that.
In the tradition?
No, in academia. You can trace linguistically all the language back to Sanskrit as the oldest language, even the Latin and Greek and the French, you just see how it grows through the centuries and also migrates, and all of the linguistic changes that are taking place. But to make sense of all of it, they think that there's some prior language that they're not certain of, that they have made up a name, because they don't have any evidence of it other than the linguistic patterns. So they have some charts showing this through time, how language has spread, you know, through the centuries and across around the world. Mm-hmm. And they show how the changes all take place. So I don't remember that much, but I studied it at one time. It's really... Mm-hmm. And then if you look at all the patronymics, you know, names for relatives, for gods, they're all the same. And you can see how they've changed.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.